So I'm calling all of my overachieving, under-receiving ladies who have been giving it their all, girl-bossing, wifing, mothering, and somehow, instead of feeling happy, content, fulfilled, and grateful, feel bitter, overwhelmed, numb, and resentful. So I'd love to give you some of my hot takes and quick tips to end this overwhelm, to shift your nervous system into a state of receiving so that you can have and hold more and so that you can handle what comes at you with more grace and ease and relaxation, because a relaxed woman is a powerful woman. So I'd love to invite you to Exhale, my free masterclass where I will share reframes to disrupt your burnout patterns. I'll be offering my signature solution as well as a free gift. So register at kellybroganmd.com/exhale or at the link in show notes. I'll see you there, beauty. I'm Dr. Kelly Brogan. You may know me as a New York Times bestselling author of a book with an exploding pill on the cover, renegade psychiatrist, pole dancer, or honorary member of the Disinformation Dozen. What can I say? I'm a born provocateur. I've spent most of my recent life exposing deceptions, connecting dots, and discovering the secret places my inner victim is still waiting to be liberated. And now I feel called to help you reclaim all of your parts, your health, your sexuality, your power, and your expression, so that you can finally truly own yourself. I want to ignite in you that inner knowing and the pulsing vitality that lives beneath your disempowerment, disconnection, and resentment, so that you can audaciously, courageously, and playfully alchemize your struggle into the specific pleasure of who you are. This is Reclamation Radio. Hi, and welcome back to Reclamation Radio. I am Dr. Kelly Brogan, and today's guest is Alyssa Jarvie, who is a longtime friend, ally, and academic intellectual collaborator. I have done extensive amounts of writing, including published case reports and case series and books, with her support, expertise, competence, and intellectual grandeur. And she is somebody who has ascended to the heights of feminist promise as a career woman, and who has modeled for me what it looks like to lay that down at the altar of motherhood and wifedom, making up that word, and all of the yield, the dividends, and the surprising experiences that attend this life as a relaxed woman. So I think of her as the best example I know of the power that we have as women, as mothers, as wives, as women in the world, to transform our experiences without requiring anyone else to get on board, to understand what we're doing, or to otherwise even support what it is that we are holding the vision for. So in today's episode, you will learn about what to do when you earn more than your husband, why a relaxed woman is a threat to modern agendas, and how to know whether you are in your red, black, or white phase of your journey as a woman. Enjoy. Alyssa, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I've been looking forward to this discussion, chat, and it's always funny for me to have my friends on the show, because first of all, it tends to be like very emotional for me. And second of all, it's hard to know how to contextualize how much amazingness there is to showcase in your life experience and also in your families. And thankfully, you have started to write about your experience, which has helped me to rest assured that people are going to know where they can go to learn more about your insights, because I think you are you epitomize so much of what is the vanguard of womanhood right now. And your experience is the best example I have in my lifescape of how a woman can change her story, turn things around, humble herself, and claim her birthright, you know, of embodied femininity. So I want to start
really zooming out with something that you said to me in a voice note that I have loved and reiterated ever since. And it has to do with the relationship between motherhood and careerism and the timing of those priorities, right? Because a lot of what we'll unpack today has to do with this myth that you can have it all, right? You can be a mother and you can be a career woman and you can be a wife and you can do it all at the same time. And isn't that amazing that we have all of these entitlements and all this freedom that we get to enjoy? And you said to me once that in a conversation that you were having with another friend of yours who was debating freezing her eggs, I guess, right? So that she could focus on her career and the fulfillment that she was, you know, hoping would lie therein. You said, you know, maybe she should freeze her career and focus on her eggs. And I thought, that's the summary, right? Like, that's the summary. And then I read in one of your articles this amazing quote that I want to sort of tee you up with, where you said, I thought that a woman who was just a mother had failed in some way. Either she didn't hustle enough to realize her potential, or she got trapped by something. Mm-hmm. And so I want to share with everyone your journey of relating to your role as mother and also high-powered career woman and intellect and academic. You know, how did that begin to shift? Like, when did the cards start to fall? And like, how was it that you began to see a different perspective about your own priorities? And did you think that those priorities were there the whole time? That's kind of the conclusion I've started to come to, is like, those were always my priorities. And I've been gaslighting myself around the, you know, the priority of my career achievement, success, my mission, even my service, you know, to humanity relative to my own family. So yeah, I'd love to just start there and hear a bit about your journey with regard to motherhood as it relates to your career.
Wow. Well, thank you for that amazing introduction. And it's an honor to be here. And I'm hoping that my story can help inspire others, listen to soul's whispers they may have, because I was one of those women who grew up in the age of STEM, where if you were doing science, technology, engineering, math, like, you had the golden ticket to success. And I was blessed to have that aptitude from an early age. And I was fortunate to have a number of scholarships, opportunities, mentors that got me to a really high place in the career world very quickly. And looking back, I see a big part of the blessing of that was having a mother who prioritized motherhood. Even though I never believed that all she wanted to be was a mother, I thought that was a cop-out or a way to make me and my three younger sisters feel better. Like, oh, you're electing to be with us. You're not just putting your life on hold to get us through school and then start living your life when we're out of the house. But that's kind of how I operated, because I would see this dichotomy of career women who were out being someone and had what looked like high status, high fulfillment, high degrees of freedom, could direct their lives, were not subject to a husband who was earning or the whims of kids, which I now, having two young kids, realize can be quite a roller coaster from day to day. So I ended up doing a PhD and postdoc at Yale in biomedical engineering and immunology. I was working on nanoparticle vaccines before they were a thing. Not really my plan, but God's plan there, and turns out to be quite relevant years later. I was a faculty member at Yale in my late 20s, teaching undergrads, working in the hospital, and trying to improve the patient experience and surgical outcomes. A lot of interesting stories there. And then was recruited to a multi-billion dollar healthcare investment firm right before I turned 30, and spent several years there in various roles. And it was, by all measures, a dream job, because we had a huge budget. I was being flown places to meet with the best and brightest in science and engineering and entrepreneurship. I had a remote job mostly before that was the norm. I was paid more than I thought I could make at my age. And I felt that I was just lucky that along the way, a courageous and totally unique, differentiated masculine man decided to court me. And we got married around the same time I started my job in healthcare investing. And I, as an investor, I could feel myself a little bit hardening, because I started to see the realities of the business of healthcare. I had seen it in academia, kind of how the research wasn't as organic as I thought it was, and that it wasn't a totally meritocratic space. And I had always felt like kind of an outsider because I did not grow up in a very academic family. So I had the advantage of pattern recognition and kind of more objective observation. And I would see a lot of people who had these high status markers of department heads or very highly cited author in the research community or getting a lot of money from pharma consulting, but often their lives were a mess. And they would either consciously or unconsciously signal that their lives were a mess. And I'd wonder, like, okay, clearly, like, this career status thing isn't quite working, but maybe they just need more money. Maybe academia is faltering because there's not enough smart investors out there who are putting money in the right place to try to change the world through healthcare innovation. And then I found myself on that side of the table with the big budgets and kind of the power position. And I saw how the human experience was flattened into data points and how things like debilitating adverse events were just put in the table and buried in the back. And it was just like all these little paper cuts on my soul as I was going. So I was in the healthcare investing world for a few years before we had our first daughter. And anyone who becomes a parent knows that everything can change in an instant, both when you realize you're pregnant and then when your baby arrives. And it's this incredible demolition of yourself and really elegant rebuilding if you let it happen. And we had decided in our very logical minds, my husband and me, that whoever liked their job more and made more money would continue working. And whoever wasn't there would quit their job and be the primary parent. And at the time, my husband had kind of gotten to the end of the road in his nuclear engineering job. I was making more money. My job was home-based. So logically, it just made sense that I would do maternity leave. And then when I came off maternity leave, I would go back to work and he would quit his job and be the primary parent. And it was great for like 2 weeks when we did that. I guess we can't really take out the confounding factor of COVID starting and the national emergency being declared 2 weeks after I went back from maternity leave. But we were then kind of thrown into this liminal space of, okay, our baby is well taken care of. She has me most of the time, like in like 30 to 60 minute stretches. I can nurse, I can hold her, I can try to connect with her in like set intervals. And my husband can take her along to Home Depot or work on his newly founded woodworking business. We can put the pack and play in the basement. He can take her on hikes. Like, this is great. She has one parent 100% dedicated to her, and she has like a 30%, maybe 25% of a mama too. And it was good, but it just kind of started to fall apart a little bit as I got busier at work. COVID was quite a busy time in the healthcare investing world. And there were new types of demands, new types of ethical gray areas that I found myself in. And the dream job that I thought it was really lost its luster after I had the experience of being with my beautiful, perfect newborn daughter. And I was just trying to like get done with the work, get done with the call so I could go back to her. And the more work I had, the harder that was. And then the shorter the intervals were. And then the more frazzled I became, because when we did this whole equation of whoever is the primary parent, we didn't know that motherhood completely changes me from the inside out. And I didn't realize the toll it would take on me and my marriage to have this arrangement, which was very culturally applauded. My husband was encouraged for being a progressive partner and really taking on the role of being a father. And he loves being a father and he's an excellent father. But there's something that mothers give their kids that is different and complementary from fathers, and I think is really critical in those first few months and first few years. And fast forward a couple of years, my second was born, a son. Both were born at home. I think that's important too for a woman's empowerment and activation. And after he was born, it went from being like tough to work to just intolerable. And that's when I knew that I had to get out. And that's when we kind of started the conversations of what would it look like if I quit my job? Not in that eloquent of terms. It was basically me saying like, I can't do this anymore. We need to figure this out. I need to quit.
And I think it's it's notable and why I love to showcase your experience to my other friends and, you know, women that I work with even, is because you are, I often refer to you as being the most competent woman I know. And you have been my favorite collaborator all of these years that, you know, we have worked together on various projects. And I've had a very inside look into the way that you can get shit done and your capacity, which I think, you know, rivals, if not surpasses mine. And I get more shit done than anybody I know. And so it's like, you know, we are the types of women who could continue to tell ourselves the story that it's fine, we've got it, we'll make it work, we'll just apply more force of will to the situation that is already declaring itself dysfunctional, and eventually it'll just work out, and life is tough, and, you know, it's the burden of not having an extended tribe and family and village, and oh well, you know. But you had what I would refer to as, you know, that little no inside that said, mm-mm. Not for me. This is not for me. And you had the audacity to listen to it. And I'd love for you to paint a picture of the, you know, the finances of your situation, if you feel down to do that, because it's really relevant. When women are breadwinning, right? It's a more extreme example of the kind of leap of faith that can be taken. However, most of us are just co-contributing, right? So it's like, you know, we both have a job, we're two income family, and we need that, right? So if we're to just sacrifice one of them, we're just going to, you know, handicap our family in a way that feels irresponsible and reckless. But you're actually the breadwinner and have all of these credentials and accolades, had built your career up to this point, were being solicited actively, you know, for even higher paying, more prestigious roles in the world. I'm constantly asking you to help me with shit, right? Like, there is so much evidence that you can commodify your intelligence and expertise. And how could that not be in the interest of your family, especially because you have this like loving husband, right? So it's just interchangeable parents, right? We're just parts and pieces that can be swapped out. And you had this little no, and you decided to listen to it. So I think it's really helpful for people to know a bit about the finances, because it leads us into the part of the conversation that has to do with choosing your role as wife. So for you, that kind of, right, like that happened a bit synchronously, but you decided to own your choice and decision to be a mother a bit before, I think, your decision to be, you know, what Laura Doyle might refer to as a surrendered wife, your decision to take on a role as wife that was not necessarily in your comfort zone. And I see a lot of it having to do with the trust-based decisions that you made around the finances in your family and the extraordinary things that emerged from that leap.
Yeah, thank you. There's so many threads we could go down there. First, I want to say that I think this notion of earning potential is a real handicap to us women doing what we actually want and focusing on what we want to do in certain phases of our lives. And at this point, I think it's safe to say almost more women have higher earning potential than their partners based on professional degrees and the amount of ourselves that we give to our employers. And I think that's kind of a misguided use of our spiritual gifts as women, where we will completely devote ourselves to a newborn, do whatever it takes to keep them alive and hopefully give them delight and comfort and raise them right. But we have been very guided into applying those competencies to a system or an employer. And when you're deploying your spiritual gifts that way, someone else is defining your worth. And for me, my worth was defined higher than I thought on the monetary scale, and provided a very comfortable income for us to be, for me, essentially making 98% of the money. My husband had a woodworking business that he started pretty much when COVID started, and was making some contributions here and there, but our living income was 98% my salary. And again, it wasn't that difficult of a job, which is another trap, because from the outside, it looked amazing. It's like, oh, I'm home. Why would I quit this? Oh, you get an auto pay like twice a month and you have excess money at the end of the month. You can do all these things and make investments. And you have this great husband who is doing a fantastic job raising the kids. So there were a lot of cultural pressures to just keep on keeping on and ignore this feeling that something was wrong and that I was not only doing a disservice to my children by not being focused on them first, but also a disservice to my marriage, my husband, and myself. And the noticing the disservice to myself was the hardest for me to acknowledge. But I think being on the other side, I see the most transformation when I finally listened to it and started the conversation with my husband that this arrangement isn't working for me. And in ways, it wasn't working for him either. And it was kind of subtle and unspoken, but I would fall into traps of superiority and felt like because I was the one earning the money, breastfeeding the kids, like running the house, I had license to be a real jerk to him and be irritable and to explode. And that was just my right because I'm the one in control and everyone has to fall under my tyrannical rule when I felt like a tyrant. And no one could really like push back on that. So I had inadvertently taken on a more masculine role in my household. And when there's someone who's taking on more masculine, then someone kind of takes on more of the feminine. And then that inverted polarity wasn't great for us as a marriage. And from the outside, like everything was fine. Everything was good. Everything was great even. But there were these little subtle things that I just felt weren't in alignment and felt that there had to be a better way if I had this longing in my heart, then there's got to be something else. And money is not going to be like more money is not going to solve this because I kept getting bonuses. I kept going up. I kept getting recruited for other jobs where I could make a jump and make even more. But it really wasn't money that I was chasing or status or title. I saw in academia, people chase titles and status, and in industry, people chase money. And I had opted out of academia and I wanted to opt out of the hedonic treadmill of money. And then the other thing that I had observed so frequently was women, particularly, who had essentially said that they will be that great wife, they will be that great mother after I make partner, after I have $1 million exit, after like it was all these career things that they felt had to happen before they could then focus on the relationships in their lives. And as you referenced in the intro, I really do think there's an order of operations for relationships, for your fertility, for building your family. And I had seen so many women who either didn't have kids because they were continually chasing the rising bar of career success. And I also saw women who had totally distant marriages, divorces, never got married, and then would find themselves alone when their career dropped them. They'd put in 30, 40 years of service to something that didn't love them back. And they get the same 2 weeks notice that the intern got. And I think a lot of that happened in COVID. So I saw it in quick succession of women who had really devoted themselves to a career and found themselves completely pushed out and then alone and regretting that they had put their career before either their husbands, their children, or any sort of relationships to create a community. The other thing I want to say on it is that there are different phases in our lives, which is something I didn't notice until I start getting older and reading more mythology. There's this amazing mythologist, Dr. Martin Shaw, who talks about the symbology of color and how it relates to life motifs. And there's red phases, there's black phases, there's white phases in healthy development. And red is associated with summer, youth, frenzy, high status, high possibilities. It's your teen years, your 20s, you're building your career, you're traveling, you don't have responsibilities, you have a ton of energy. And then in a natural arc, you get into a black phase, which is more of a descent. It's a loss of something. It can be associated with lower possibilities, lower status. But even though things are slowing down on the outside, you're having so much soul fortification and there's so much work being done on the inside. And you're going into a new phase where you get to the white, which is the marriage of your inner polarities. And that's when many artists do their greatest works. And when you can develop empathy and leadership. And our culture is so obsessed with red. And we as women just keep building on the red unless we let ourselves be taken down into the underworld of motherhood or wifehood, which are the most amazing initiations and transformations if you let yourself be worked on and taken apart so you can be reconfigured in a new, humbler, more empathetic way.
I believe the recording I recommend more than any other is my Victimless Mothering Workshop, which is the product of 14 years of motherhood, where I help smoke out the reflexive, control-based habits of unconscious parenting, and specifically the way that conditional love hides in the well-meaning, holistic mama vibes of a woman like me who is so convinced that she's ending all the abuse of her mother line by imposing rules meant to protect her kids against toxic food, tech, and pharma. I have been humbled and I've seen some darkness in my own righteousness and in the holistic health mothering world. So I want to open the conversation and I think it went really well. So I'd love to share these recordings with you. An attendee said, I was pretty emotional during the call. I journaled like 10 pages afterwards. My husband told me I looked happier already and I feel lighter. That call with Kelly felt like 10 years of therapy in 1 hour. It cut through to the core. So I hope you'll check it out and commit with me to truly ending victim consciousness and fear-based parenting in all of the places that it hides. The link is in show notes.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because you introduced me to Martin Shaw's work and the Handless Maiden, which then became a feature in The Reclaimed Woman, which you helped me to edit. And there is probably no better tale of the heroine's journey. And I think it's entirely a function of the programming that we are indistinguishable from men, that we might imagine that we could subsist in this red phase, right? Like just never ending, efforting, driving, you know, achievement and goal-oriented behavior when the cyclical nature of alchemy is such that if you resist entering, you know, one of these phases, you don't get the gift, like you don't get the yield, you don't get to experience the complementary nature of opposites within or without. So speaking of without, so you talked about how you were in this very relatable inverse polarity with your husband, you know, feeling not only that martyr energy, but also probably, you know, very entrenched in the habits of I can do it better than him. You know, clearly, look how much I'm doing. And I also feel unsupported, right? And I feel like it's too much. So when you had this conversation in him, you said that there was some part of him that also felt like, something's not quite working here, even though on paper, or even to the outside observer, it might have seemed like they have a really great situation going on. So when you proposed that as, you know, as lucrative breadwinner, you were no longer interested in, you know, being the career woman that you had set up your entire life to be, right? So the vulnerability of that admission, I think, is big. It's notable, right? Because there's almost the acknowledgement that what you have prioritized up until that point might have been like wrong-minded or like might have been like a mistake of some sort. At least that's something that I grapple with in my own life, right? Like the idea that everything that I was working towards all these years, it's just a trap we fall into of making wrong like what we were doing when we're ready to change, right? So you get to this moment and you tell him that it's not working for you. And did you come up with a solution? Did you empower him to solve the problem? Like what actually happened?
Yeah. So I think to the first point, I don't know if there are any mistakes that were made in how we live our lives because we're doing different things in different phases and we have different needs and different levels of responsibility and those relating to us. So I don't regret the career arc I've had. it probably went on a little too long. If I could, I truncated it a couple of years, but I feel fortunate that I truncated it when I did. And I'm not saying I wish I truncated it 20 years ago. It's I wish I truncated 2 years.
When you had kids, maybe.
I wish once I had my first, I listened to that voice saying no, because I remember right after I had my daughter and I was about to finish maternity leave, I had a call with a high level person in the firm and I'm watching my newborn daughter in the swing sleeping, just so in love, like so in her rhythms. And this woman who sounded shrill after like 2.5 months of just baby days was like, well, you know, you need like to get on the partner track, like transfer to this boss, make sure you go to New York office twice a month, Boston office twice a month, fly out to San Francisco like once a month and, you know, do this, this, this. And I was just staring at my daughter thinking, no, 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 like, thank you. I agree. Like your advice is sound if I wanted to do this and I no longer want to do this. So I wish I had the courage to have quit then, but there are so many external circumstances because if I had quit then, that would have been March 1st, 2020. So it's one of those things where you don't know the context and the backdrop and what else is happening. So I do think timing is perfect in its own ways for all the lessons. And now I can look back and empathize with people in various stages of this. But I do wish I had known more what I know on the other side, which is why I'm happy we're having this conversation. So what it looked like, So Arthur was a few months old, my second, and I was supposed to go on this work trip that I knew was totally a waste. I didn't want to see the people. I didn't want to do the project. I was completely against it internally, but I went and I essentially had a breakdown while I was there. Because I was still nursing, so I was scurrying into the bathroom to pump. I like leaked through a shirt at one point. It was just a mess. And I was like crying, like, why am I doing this? So I came home from that and told my husband, like, I am done. Like, you need to figure this out. I am not doing this anymore. You have 12 months. And that was essentially how it went. So at first, I was still in my control mindset of I know better than him. So I was like, you need to close these deals for the woodworking business. You need to make this much money a month. You need to do this, this, and this. And like cajoling him to essentially make his woodworking business be enough to pay our bills. And since we were making more money than we ever expected to make, our bills had gone up and we were living a bit superfluously. So it would have been more than he was making what his engineering job before. So it was a pretty high target to go from a single or low double digit thousands to like, you know, six figures. But I was like, well, I'm not going to do it. So you better do it. And his response at first was not satisfactory to me because he said like, we can just live in a trailer. Like, he's like, I don't care. Like, quit your job tomorrow. You're not happy. I don't care if we're poor. We both grew up without much. We could grab some family land in Maine. Grab a cabin, grab a double wide and like live mortgage free, which has its appeal in its own way, but it's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted him to like rescue me and say like, yes, of course, I'm going to handle this random emotional outburst and come up with an amazing plan as I'm trying to juggle our 1 and 3 or 6 month and 2.5 year old. It was just a total random attack. So I didn't like that answer, but I realized that if I just quit, I had this unshakable faith that it would work out and that I would never know what he was capable of or our family was capable of if I didn't just quit. And it was right along the timeline I told him. The wood business was making more money at the 12-month mark, but not enough to pay our bills. But I went ahead and quit anyway. And we had this really actually magical free fall of not knowing what was going to happen. And I had this piece that I can't explain. And right after I quit, it was as if Donald remembered who he was and all the strength he had and all the competencies he had, because I had finally stopped trying to make him do things my way. And he was like, oh, I'll just get a remote engineering job, capitalize on my 10 years of very differentiated and valuable experience and do the woodworking on the side. And as soon as he totally shifted his mindset. We had never even thought of it, which is kind of silly. He had more offers than he could, he ended up taking one, which was the highest paying. It was 100% remote. Fast forward to when he started, he loves it. He's getting promoted. He's ascending responsibility. He loves his boss. They love him. He's working overtime and he's making a lot of money. And it went from zero to a lot. And it was because I went from a lot to zero. And we pretty much switched in 3 months after I quit.
It moves me so deeply to hear this. And we've been talking about this for a while. It's not the first time I've heard this story. And I need to put in neon lights what you shared about that reframe of the free fall, of the uncertainty, of the trust. Because I also know, as your friend, that was a moment in your journey where you began to connect with God on a level that blossomed like a gorgeous bouquet. And that opportunity that we generate for ourselves, if we miss it, not only do we stay in the struggle, in the victim story, in the stress physiology, but we don't get to relish the experience of feeling held by a greater design. And the remembrance that you, as the wife, afforded your husband, it feels to me like a remembrance to hear about. Like, yes, this is how it's supposed to be. He can solve this better than you can. And again, I will reemphasize that you are a bad bitch. You can solve a lot of problems. Okay. So the fact that your husband solved this problem of providing for your family better than you could is very notable with you specifically as an example. And I know that led to a period that I believe is ongoing of experimentation with the principles of a surrendered or empowered, however you want to phrase it, wife. And we've, both been exploring Laura Doyle's work and how it can be applied in different circumstances. And, she herself is not a mother. So applying this as a mother, I think, is a really important lens to introduce women to if they haven't heard about this. So I'd love to share a little bit about what you've been playing with since then as a wife, because I think that was also the next vista, right? It was the next playground to explore, how could you be Alyssa even more while being even less of the Alyssa you knew yourself to be, right?
Yeah. I do want to back up. You had mentioned getting closer to God. That's a really, really important framework for basically 2023 was when this all went down in early 2020. So I told Donald in summer of 2022, I'm done. You have a year. So that whole summer 2023 was on our mind for a long time. In January 2023, a friend invited me to a motherhood group at a church. And I grew up kind of check the box, religious, Catholic, tried different churches. Once we got married, didn't really find anything that stuck. But I went to this motherhood group and I was just in awe of these women. Because first of all, it was 9:30 a.m. on a Thursday. So these were women who didn't work. I could do it because I could get my work done from 8 to 9:15, go there and then rush back and continue working. So there were about 50 or 60 women who were just beautiful and radiant and connecting with each other and having authentic community, and their kids were being taken care of in the building next door. And we were just there to listen to a speaker, to eat really good food, and to be in book group discussions. And I was like, what is this? This is amazing. And it's free. So that was my first encounter with Christian women and seeing that they were being sustained by something that I was not familiar with. And I was curious, to say the least. And then that same friend invited us to a church a couple months later. And my husband and I both had a felt experience of feeling at home and also being very interested to continue. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the week I quit, I also got baptized. And once I quit and got baptized, it was just a recognition that I had been putting much too much pressure on my husband to save me. And that's a charge that no mortal human can endure and perform well enough to my changing standards of what I needed for a rescue. and that I had to go higher than humanity to really place my faith. And when we both started putting our faith into God, these ideas would just come and these opportunities would just show up. The job that Donald got is a remote job in Alabama that's exactly specialized for what he had been doing in Connecticut for 10 years. And they were looking specifically for someone like him. And how could that happen? We had no idea it existed. So I think God really meets us in the suffering, and God loves it when we hand over control and we say, I've heard your voice for so long telling me to make this change. Okay, I'm going to make this change. I don't know where it's going. I'm terrified. We might lose our house. I don't even know, but I'm listening to that voice inside of me, and I have this faith and peace that something's going to emerge. And as you alluded to, what emerged was better than anything I could have planned. And I think that's such a testament to surrendering, both to God and to one's husband, because if you married him, shouldn't you trust him? Shouldn't you think he's capable?
$1 million question.
Yeah. Wasn't he existing perfectly fine before you got married? Wasn't he paying his bills, making somewhat decent decisions, living in a house that was habitable? And it's just funny how I think culturally we immediately downgrade our husbands, like as soon as we get married. And then we kind of keep doing that as we have our feminine superiority, which can be proven out in lived experiences if you're the breadwinner, because you're like, hey, like, why do I need him? I'm making the money. I'm cleaning the house. I'm basically raising the kids. And you can get these unconscious resentments and victim stories of, you can't do it right. Why does no one help me? It's like, well, why would he help you if you don't think he can do anything to your standards? So that was probably a really big moment of surrender. But prior to that, also around the time I met the Christian women and ended up joining the church, was when I read Laura Doyle's book, and certain phrases just really stuck out to me, like, whatever you think, when he asks something. And there are times where, rarely actually, where I'll be like, no, really, I want you to tell me what you think. Usually it's like a me reflecting a question and him realizing that I have faith in him. And since I read that book, I became so hyper aware of how many times I told him to do something and I was wrong. Like even in church this last weekend, I laughed because we're always a couple minutes late. So we almost always are in the front. And this time we're late. And I was like, can we not go in the front? And he's like, all right, you go find a seat. And we walk in, and one of the pastors is like, oh, hey guys, you guys are always in the front. So go up to the front. I'm like, all right, I guess we're in the front. But there was kind of like a gift handout where it was actually advantageous to be in the front. And I was like, oh, of course, like here I am getting humbled, telling him what to do, even though he's doing the best in the situation we're in and it works. And actually it was better that we were in the front. Or I'll tell him like, park here, and it's not the right place to park. But I think ultimately, when I stopped trying to tell him what to do, I opened myself up to be surprised and delighted and really impressed with the creative solutions that he would come up with. And sometimes it wouldn't be on my timeline, but how often are things actually on our timelines? And I also realized some of the things that I would say to him, I would be so angry if he said to me. There was an example where I said I was going to clean the playroom, and I kept saying like, oh, next week, I'm going to clean the playroom next week. He never nagged me on it. And then one day I cleaned the playroom and I was like, okay, this took me like 5 weeks, but I did it. And I realized all the times where he'd say like, oh, I need to fix that. And I'd be like, when are you going to fix it? When are you going to fix it? Why don't you stop doing what you're doing and fix that? And I thought if he had said that about the playroom, I would have been so upset. And it's really not fair and not kind and not intimate to be trying to control another person, especially because I chose this person because I liked how they existed for me.
You might have a sense that supporting your energetic and subtle body is important, but how exactly does one do that? Like, short of scheduling regular sessions with an energy healer, how do you do that? Most of the time I find that when we take supplements, it's from the energy of fixing ourselves. And honestly, it's really no different than taking a medication at that point. That's why I love Flower Remedies, and specifically my girl Katie Hess's elixirs from Lotus Way. The formulations that she creates are so nuanced that sometimes it feels like I wrote the descriptions myself. The last one I took was designed to dissolve go-go-go mentality, as well as fatigue, weakness, apathy, and resistance to self-care. I have a monthly membership called Flower Revolution where I get a new and super powerful on-point remedy sent to me every month, and it blows my mind how resonant each one is with exactly where I am in my process. I think of this as a truly feminine investment that harmonizes my process and allows me to walk, talk, and interact with grace. You can try it for a month or six at the link below. And if you just want to dip a toe in to learn more about how flowers heal, you can take their quiz.
Did you have any experiences of, you know, watching him actually fail? Because you talk about these instances where he ended up being right, despite your, you know, maybe covertly held belief that you knew better in the moment. But reversing this polarity obviously can be treacherous because there's a lot of reinforced superiority, inferiority, but also the masculine wound of being a failure and fundamentally like flawed. And not that we don't all have that wound, but it's right, a particular flavor and expression of it is probably really exacerbated in those vulnerable moments where you let him take the wheel, you let him actually try, you let him commandeer, and he's feeling you watching him to see if he's going to actually do it well. I imagine that there's, you know, and I've certainly heard that it's common that there is a lot of like, you know, failing, especially in these transitions as they happen, and that allowing your man to fail, allowing him to fuck up, is a part of investing in the dividends that you actually want as a woman, ultimately, which is that he develops the esteem, confidence, and your unwavering gaze and faith in him as a man. So did you experience that kind of thing? Or was it just pretty much an immediate transition into like, you know, he's got the wheel and this is actually better for both of us?
Yeah, I think with the job thing, there were ups and downs. It's been about a year, so it's a little bit hazy, but there were times where the first job offer he got, I kind of wanted him to take because I was like, oh, good, this will work. And he was like, no, it's not exactly what I want. And I'm thinking like, oh my gosh, are you going to hold out for this exact job? And in my mind, I'm like, it probably doesn't exist because he's got very specific things. And he didn't take that first job. And I'm so glad he didn't, because then better ones came. But it definitely, I think for that wasn't failure, but a lot of holding my tongue and trying not to put time pressure on things. And I think there's like tiny instances of failure week to week. But I think when you have the room to fail, you can get the beauty from it. So the one I thought of was last weekend, he has sold all these cedarwood Christmas ornaments to a local store. And he was supposed to meet the person like Saturday morning to show the ornament prototype that he had made. And then Saturday morning, he's looking, he can't find it. He's like, I know I made it, but I can't find it. I'm holding my tongue, like, gosh, I'm not going to say, like, you should have put it here, but I'm just like, let him. And he like couldn't find it. And I like was like, oh, that's too bad. And he's like, you know, I'm just going to go in the basement and make it another one, but I'm also going to do like three variations to see if she wants like other things too. He's like, so I'll just call her and tell her I'll be a couple hours late, but she's at the store all day. It's okay. But I'll have more stuff. And I'm thinking like, this is a pretty good rescue of what looks like a failure. So he made them, he went there, and she loved all three. And it's like, wow, if he didn't lose it, he wouldn't have done it. And if I came down on him, he probably wouldn't have done that either. It probably would have been like an adversarial thing. And I think it's just grace that I want extended to me, and that I try really hard to extend to my kids and other people. And I think it's the hardest to extend to yourself and your spouse. So as I extend it to him, I'm getting better at extending it to myself. And I see the more I can separate failures and behaviors from the character of a person, the less hard on myself I am too.
I love this. It just makes so much sense. And I'd love to
round out our discussion with, you know, sort of a treatment of this idea of a relaxed woman, because you left me a message once and you were describing this moment where your daughter was riding her bike and you were outside with her and you just had nothing else to do, right? So you had quit your job. You were, you know, through this transition of your husband taking over as breadwinner, you had already a totally different experience of what it was to relate to money, right? Since he was the one earning it, to relate to your schedule, to relate to your responsibilities. And you were just watching her ride her bike with absolutely nothing else pulling at you. And your best resources were now being offered to your family, to your daughter, to your, you know, son, to your husband. And when I listened to that message, I felt this like ache, this like twist of grief, you know, in my core, because to this day, I have never experienced such a moment. And I, you know, I credit my career and the primacy of my career to that reality, even in the golden handcuffs kind of, and a, you know, extraordinary job and vocation that I enjoy now, there is never actually that capacity to be fully present to what is in front of me. And it's especially painful when it's my own kids, right? So like when I, and I've been making, you know, as you know, this transition over the past year myself to put my own experience of mothering first. And I've noticed these subtle moments that I, you know, I think of you because, you know, I'll be doing the dishes and I used to think about the dishes as like units of productivity.
Something to get through. Yeah.
Yeah. That were being like stolen from my work, my, you know, and it's something I could be doing where I could be like making more money for the family or like,
this is not a revenue generating activity.
Right?
I know.
Right. And so, you know, when I decenter my career and I centralize my daughters, doing the dishes becomes just part of the devotional practice of the home and caretaking them. And it has an entirely different, you know, role in my lifescape than if it is competing with time that I would be spending doing something productive for my career. So you wrote the sentence in one of your Substack articles where you say, seated in our natural roles, actually knowing and delighting in our children instead of seeing them as something else to manage, appreciated by our husbands and buoyed by friendships, we question more and we purchase less. So you talk about how a relaxed woman is potentially the greatest threat. And I couldn't agree more, and is part of the thrust of what the Reclaimed Woman is all about. So I wonder if you could share a little bit, you know, for those of us on the other side of the fence here, you know, about what that has felt like. And maybe even some of the challenges, maybe even on a nervous system level, of easing into this comportment towards your environment, your life, your relationships, and really, yeah, like what you've enjoyed as somebody who now has touched that dimension of her femininity.
Yeah, I feel so blessed, honestly, to be in this place because I didn't know if it existed. I was hoping it did, but wasn't sure. Once I had seen it with other women and other families, I felt more confident. But then it's always, does this exist for me? And that's a question you don't know the answer to until you take the leap and give it time. Because it definitely took me a few months to relax. I'm still not fully relaxed. That's the goal. But I went from such a overstimulating environment where it'd be like a call with high stakes, power plays, making someone wrong so someone else could feel right. It was very an emotionally charged work being an investor. And then I would try to like be like, soften, soften, soften. I have an hour with my kids. And then I try to like switch to that. And then it might be a nice hour. It might be an hour of food on the floor and getting hit with the plate as you're picking it up. And then it's like, oh, why am I doing this? I do everything for them and martyr, martyr, martyr. And then I try to go back and be armored up and intense and witty and I don't know. So it took probably 3 to 5 months, I think, to really kind of come off of all that dopamine addiction and to feel adequately stimulated by being with my kids. because the pace is totally different. Right now, they're 2.5 and 4.5. And slowing down, being with them is definitely an off-ramp. And I kind of knew that from also surrendering in my marriage. Like, at first, it's probably going to feel weird and fake, but just like try to be in it and lead with how I want it to be. And then it kind of follows you and becomes real, and you're not like actively trying to be a certain way anymore. I think like being able to flow with the natural rhythms of kids just reduces so much friction, because I like feel deep empathy for my friends who have to get their kids up before they want to wake up, get them ready, get them in the car, drop them off here, run to work. And those rushed mornings are like the worst of us. That's the high stress times. That's when we flip out because, you know, your 2-year-old lost his shoe, and that's a normal thing for a 2-year-old to do. But when it happens on when you need to be somewhere else, or you feel you need to be somewhere else, it brings out these really scary parts of yourself. And I wanted to change my context to stop bringing out so many scary parts and start bringing out more beautiful parts. And it really took the macro context switching for that to happen. And I think I had so much repression of my natural sensitivities from the years, the 20 years of hustling, that they're coming back online slowly. And I'm afforded a kind of presence and gratitude and just awareness of how blessed I am and how I have this incredible husband and incredibly stimulating children once I stop expecting them to be like the adult world and meet them in their microcosms of their unarmored awareness and the abundance of joy they have just being outside and trying to get into that role, and also just an unconscious remembering of, wow, that's me too. Like, especially with a daughter, I feel like it's somewhat easier to recognize yourself in them and then maybe try to do some things differently than were done to you at that age, and honor their souls and how they're processing the world instead of trying to match them to the level that you're at in your late 30s and having all the life experiences that I've had.
And I wonder if you could say a word, because I alluded to it, about what it feels like in this state to be provided for, you know, like what is the money coming in feel like to you?
It's really nice. Honestly, I used to like kind of religiously check the bank account and think about what I was spending. And I just don't really think about it that much anymore. And when we get windfalls, we're both happy. And on like a day to day, I'm not using it as a reason to be stressed or a false idol, because it's not even something that's taking too much of my attention. And since I was a child, I haven't had that experience of being provided for and cared for. And I can see that my husband likes that too. Like, it's just this great feedback loop where he's more confident. He wants to provide for us. And the gift that I can give him, and even that he said, is for me to enjoy it.
Yes, yes, yes. You are such an inspiration. Your family is an inspiration to me. And I know that you're at the vanguard of a movement I have felt effervescing within me and just haven't had, you know, the timing that you are enjoying to put it into practice. And I'm very excited that you're documenting your journey and your Substack. We'll make sure that that's linked, which is also supportive of your latest endeavor, which I'd love for you to share a word or two about. And then I'd love to ask, you know, like, what would you whisper in the ear of a woman who is newly pregnant, starting her, you know, her role as mother in the world, whether or not she can hear it, you know, like, what do you feel would be like an important thing to, you know, to suggest to her, invite her toward?
I know so many things. So for the first question, I think not having to work for money has afforded me the ability to hear creative impulses and then direct my competencies towards those creative impulses. And I'm seeing it with a lot of other relaxed women that when we don't have to hustle for an employer, the things that we feel are right or we want to see in the world, we can use those skills that we got out in the world to make those come to fruition, but doing it in a non-transactional, more of an offering type of context. So for me personally, something that I would love to see in the world and am taking steps to bring forward is a nature-based community center for multi-generational wisdom sharing and homeschool enrichment programs. And we have a nonprofit called the River Valley Collective. We have a growing group of families who are different yet overlapping in several values of cherishing childhood, creating a safe space for souls flourishing, and tapping into the vast abundance of our local community and the resources we're afforded living in the Connecticut River Valley area. And then what would I tell a woman about to have her first kid? I think maybe that life can be simpler. And a simple life is not what our culture wants us to think will be fulfilling, because then we would not have to buy things and follow different authorities. I would say that choosing motherhood and wifehood intentionally is humbling, but in that humbling, you can hear God and feel that you're discovering new parts of yourself or parts that have been there all along, and that your contentment can then be based on internal, not external factors, and that there will always be a time for a career. And I feel that really leaning into motherhood is already, but it's making me a better entrepreneur because we have other ventures, some solo, some with my husband, makes me a better entrepreneur. But also if I do decide to re-enter the career world, I know that I will be even more competent and more empathetic and more holistically oriented, and that these crucial young years are, and everyone says it, you can't get the time back, but it's true. And I would rather heavily invest in my children than invest in external sources of status or perceived safety, and trust that what feels right with our maternal instincts is where directing our energy will yield the greatest fruits. And I'd say the last thing would be that our children give us a permission slip to opt out of what we think we're supposed to be doing and either lean into or discover what we want to be doing. And when we're oriented in that way, whatever we birth along with our children will be of more service to the world than trying to change the world with our careers.
Well, that's a mic drop. I love you, woman. And I'm so, so, so excited that we put this on record instead of just in our personal voice notes. And I am so here for the ripple effects of this, not only in your own sphere, but for those families listening. And I'm just very grateful. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I love you too. And thank you for this opportunity and for all your support and encouragement along the way.